Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us, and enjoy the show.
You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio, broadcasting to you from the Bywater neighborhood in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm joined today by filmmaker Lily Kieber, the force behind the documentary Bayou Maharaja, The Tragic Genius of James Booker. Lily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into things, tell me a little bit about your background.
Sure. I was born and raised in North Carolina. I always make the distinction that I'm a hillbilly, not a redneck. And then I went to high school in Georgia, and then I went to high school and college in Georgia. Went to high school in Savannah, and then University of Georgia. And I studied fabric design, which was a lot of fun, and probably second only to basket weaving as like the least most helpful degree that you could possibly get. But I enjoyed it, and I got out of college. And then I found filmmaking kind of after that. And once I found documentary filmmaking, I knew that that was just the coolest thing in the world, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
So for listeners out there who are not familiar with James Booker, he is one of the most interesting characters in New Orleans history. Tell us a little bit about who he is.
Absolutely, and that's a steep pedigree, you know, because New Orleans has had some crazy characters. James Booker is first and foremost one of the most accomplished piano players, not only from New Orleans, I'd say, but from America. His style is very distinct. He was a child prodigy, studied classical music as a kid, and then combined that with a universal understanding of music, you know, and then that just je ne sais quoi that is New Orleans, you know, it's just, it bubbles up from the streets here. So he could play any style, but really what he's known for is just being able to combine all of those into one. So if you went to a James Booker gig, it might start off with a Rachmaninoff song and then go into Sinatra or Fats Domino, or he might change keys to match a car honking outside. And then he might just stop playing and rant at the audience for an hour. You know, it's someone in the film says that, you know, trying to capture Booker was like trying to capture the wind. And I think it's true. There's the music on one side, but then also James Booker was, you know, a very troubled soul. You know, this is radio, so I guess the first thing I had to do is just to describe his visual. He had an eye patch, and not only did he have an eye patch, but he always wore a star on it. You know, so anytime you see a musician with an eye patch with a star, I can guarantee it's James Booker. And he was African-American, he was queer, he was bipolar, he was a genius, he was a drug addict, you know, he was so many things all at the same time. And I think sort of like his music, you know, just you never knew what you were going to get with him. You know, he had a tough road in life, but I think that we're all so lucky that, you know, he was able to translate that into this phenomenal music.
the first time that I learned about James Booker, I was, a line cook here in New Orleans. And I remember it's actually, you've got the picture in here of James Booker wearing this, is that a captain's hat? Or
it's a police hat.
It's a police hat. He's wearing a police hat and some kind of underwear. And
ladies' underwear.
Ladies' mm-hmm. underwear. And, you know, I would just be cooking on the line, sweating, and the chef said, that's James Booker. He's one of the most important musicians of all time. And I didn't know who he was, so I Googled him, and at the time, there wasn't a whole lot. Just knew the music. So, how did you first discover him?
I discovered James Booker in much the same way. You know, I moved to New Orleans and I never heard of him, and I'd play him at the jukebox, when I was bartending. And same sort of thing, you know. Everyone in New Orleans seemed to know who he was, or, you know, who he is. You know, we still use the present tense. And also have these crazy stories, and also totally love him, and also, you know, revere the music. But it's like, who is this guy that everyone here has heard of, and yet no one that I know, you know, has ever heard of him? And same thing, there was very little online. There weren't a lot of albums available at the time. And it was just like a mystery wrapped in a mystery. But, you know, for me, there was just something in the music that grabbed me and kept me interested. And I have to say, you know, after all these years of working on the film, he is still a mystery to me, you know, and it's something I really like. You know, he's not an easy ball to unravel.
He only released 3 albums in his lifetime, or something along those lines. And, why do you
think... America.
In America, okay.
He had more released in his lifetime in Europe, but those were never released. They were released... Well, it's a long story. With Booker, nothing is easy. Even to say how many albums he had is really hard.
Well, you know, why is it such a mystery? Why, you know, in the process of kind of uncovering who this person was, why do you think it's been so difficult to sort of track him down, so to speak?
Well, for one, I think he was hard to pin down in his lifetime. I mean, I knew from the get-go that I wanted to interview a lot of people because he seemed so different to everyone, you know, and I think it's true that everyone saw a different side of him, and I think that, you know, some of that was intentional. He presented a different side of himself to different people and in different situations, you know, but also he didn't do himself any favors, you know, with the albums. He might... You know, who'd sign a contract with one person and sign another contract, you know, which, you know, so then today, who actually owns the rights to these albums, and are they, in fact, you know, out of print, and da-da-da-da, to try to get them back in print is really complicated, you know. So, you know, his business savvy wasn't, up to snuff, but also he was a junkie, you know. Like, if someone's going to pay him to play, of course he's going to say yes, you know. He's not going to read the fine print. You know, I think that also, I find that a lot of the crazy stories that people remember of him, they always assume that it was drug use, you know, but also he was, to the best of my abilities, to the best I can tell, he was also bipolar. So that certainly complicates matters more. And then just the stories that his friends tell of him, you know, you'd be sitting next to him 1 minute and then you'd turn around and he's just gone. You know, he's constantly disappearing. People didn't know where he was. You know, he would show up under aliases. He was here, there. You know, I think that he was a hard person to get to know, and a hard person to be close to. And then I think that also his music is hard to digest. You know, it's not easy listening. It's not for the, passive listener. You really have to be willing to go there emotionally with the music in order to get that out of it. You know, it's not like it's certainly not top 40, you know, but it's almost like when I hear, let's say, a Sam Cooke song or an Otis Redding song, like, I know how to listen to that. You know, I know that it's going to be, the chorus is going to come up now, I know how many measures it's going to be, I know where it's going to go, you know, I know there's going to be a happy ending at the end of it, you know, or a sad ending, but with Booker, you just don't know where it's going to go. You don't know how long the song is going to go on. You don't know, what he's doing now. What are all these references? It's just unlike any music I've ever heard. And then, you know, always the first question that people are going to ask, the first question is also the most difficult. Like, well, what kind of music is? well, you know, it's not exactly jazz, it's not exactly blues, it's not exactly soul, it's not exactly R&B, like, it's a combination of all of those. So he combines it and then he turns it on his head. So then where are you even going to put it in the CD store, you know, if we still had CD stores? You know, like, you can't really put it in the jazz section, because jazz purists aren't going to buy that, you know? You can't really put it in the R&B. But what it is that his music transcends genre, you know? It says a bigger statement about music and, you know, what music is and what it can be, you know, if we didn't limit it with these labels. But at the same time, that makes it a lot more tricky, you know? Again, I've been trying to describe his music for years, and I still can't do a good job of it. You know, all you can do is sit down and listen to it. But again, it's... A good friend of mine describes it as crazy people music. You know, like, you have to really be ready for that raw edge that it presents. And that's what I think so many of us love about it. But it just, you know, it can make you uncomfortable at first.
Didn't he always described it as spiders on the keys?
I think that maybe other people described it because it sounded like someone had let loose, you know, a gang of spiders on the keys, because it's just so many notes at one time. And it's something that people often say is, you know, they'll sit down, like the first time they listen to it, especially if they play piano or no piano, you know, sit down and listen to it and like, okay, that's cool, but who's the other person playing? You know, they can't believe that it's only two hands on the piano. It's just more notes than any other piano player is capable of playing at the same time.
What is the James Booker song that got you hooked or that taught you what he was doing?
God, it's so embarrassing. But for me, it was Sunny Side of the Street. You know, it's like such an easy song, such a like sweet song. You know, it's like so common, you hear all the time. But I think that maybe, you know, for me, it was my Rosetta Stone. You know, it was the one that allowed me in, you know, because I know the song Sunny Side of the Street, but I'd never heard it played like that before. And I think for me personally, it was just that question of like, what is it about this song that makes it so different than all the other versions? And, you know, one of my favorite parts in the film is I have Harry Connick Jr., he chose that song, Sunnyside, to sort of, you know, to take Booker style and break it down, you know, so just note by note, here's what's happening. And it's true, you know, it's, I guess the mark of the ultimate, I don't know, the ultimate musician, that they can make something that complicated sound that simple, you know, that easy, that smooth. So it is really deceptively smooth. But it's also, you know, it's the sunny side of the street. It's so sweet. And, you know, that's sort of like the Booker 101, you know. And now probably my favorite song is his Taste of Honey, where he starts off with Rachmaninoff and goes into Taste of Honey. And really, I feel like everything that you need to know about James Booker is like encapsulated in that 6 minutes of that song. But it's scary, you know. It's like not music to listen to alone at night if you're lonely or brokenhearted, you know. But yeah.
So, you know, you interview lots of different people in the documentary, you know, Irma Thomas, Dr. John. What was your process for just finding the folks or finding any information on him? And what was sort of that journey of learning more and more from different people?
Well, when I started out, you know, like I said, I really didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody, you know. I was a nobody. I was just a bartender, you know, who wanted to make a film. And so I started, I guess, reading what was available. You know, there's a chapter about Booker in one of Jeff Hanisch's books, and there's a chapter in Up from the Cradle of Jazz. And there was a biography online. You know, I started there, and again, just started talking to people, and one person would lead me to another person. Oh, you got to talk to this person, you know, call. And New Orleans is ultimately a very small town, you know, sort of disguised as a city. And, you know, it's not that hard to get a hold of people. You know, people, New Orleanians are very humble and very, you know, approachable. So some musicians I would just walk up to and talk to after their gig, or others I would just have looked up in the phone book or, you know, on MySpace, like back in the days of MySpace. And then there's people like Cosmo Matassa, you know, the great Cosmo Matassa, sound engineer, you know, single-handedly sort of put together the sound of 1950s R&B in New Orleans. This legend, now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, turns out he's just upstairs at the grocery store that his family owns. He's upstairs at Matassa's. Like, it, you know, it makes sense, and yet it makes no sense at all. You know, that a legend would still just be, like, doing the books at his family grocery store. You know, so that's how I got started. And then I put together a trailer, you know, so that people could see the kind of film that I was going to make. And that was a question I got a lot. You know, no one ever asked me where I went to film school, but, you know, they were, which is good, because I didn't. But, you know, they were curious to see, you know, is she going to play up the crazy, outrageous, throw up on the piano side of James Booker, or is she going to, you know, play up the he is a stunning musician side, you know? And in the end, I tried to do both. You know, and I think that also I'm lucky that Booker is so revered by musicians, you know, and by people here. And it was apparent that his memory was on the precipice of being forgotten. You know, a lot of these people are old, you know, and wouldn't be around a whole lot longer. You know, and just this year, 2013, will mark 30 years since he died. And I think there was just that sort of collective feeling that there wasn't a lot that had been done in 30 years. You know, there's a wonderful radio documentary, but there, you know, it was time. It was time that someone, you know, made this film.
I mean, you brought him back from the dead, you know? And
that's what Dr. John told me, too. It's like, oh my God, the responsibility, you know, that's a heavy load right there.
Well, you know, in this process, what was a moment where you discovered something, whether it was something interesting about him or, you know, anything that just sort of amazed you?
I mean, everything about him is amazing and so elusive and so funny, too. I think that was a big relief for me, was that, like, you know, that he's funny. It's not like a downer story. I think that probably the most amazing thing for me was learning the music, you know, because again, I started it with an emotional connection to the music, so it was sort of a nice discovery along the way to also find out that he is, like, one of our best piano players. Oh, that's handy. You know, and again, I'm just too dense, I guess, a listener to, like, I didn't have the, you know, the sophisticated ear, I guess, and really to be able to pick up that, you know? But the stories along the way, let's think of a good one. He started playing really young. He played on radio stations around New Orleans from the get-go. And then, you know, back in the 50s, the media wasn't like the media today. You know, like, people would know the songs, but there weren't, like, a lot of images of what musicians look like, especially for African-American musicians. Like, you know, they're just... I remember Irma Thomas telling me that that at the time, African-American musicians, like, they would never have their picture on the front of the album. You know, like, I think maybe eventually Fats Domino was one of the first, and his picture was on the back cover, you know. So it took a long time, you know, to get that... It's such a funny thing. I mean, like, today, to think back, that's how these people, you know, like, that's the reality that they had to grow up with. But because of that, back then, a lot of musical acts would go out, and they would be, they'd be, like, fake musical acts. So Booker was one of these. He would go out on the road as Huey Piano Smith. And he could certainly play like Huey Piano Smith, so, like, they would go on the road and he would sound like the albums, and people had no idea that he wasn't, you know, because they didn't know what he looked like. You know, and there would be these little gangs of musicians that would go out, like, as Shirley and Lee, even though, you know, they're totally fake. And I don't know, for me, it just cracked me up, the thought that it worked, ultimately. You know, Booker did that a lot. He played piano on some of the Fats Domino records. You know, that people think it's Fats playing, but Fats was on the road so much that they would have Booker come in and lay down the tracks. You know, he's one of these that, like, his sound is in so many songs that you know. You know, just no one knows who he is. don't know. And then there's all the outrageous stories, and, you know, like, Booker would actually quite, it's not uncommon. I've heard several versions of the story. You know, he might be, like, at Tipitina's playing piano and then just stop and put a gun to his head and demand, like, I'm not going to play another note until someone brings me some cocaine. And there'd be some expletives in there that I'm not going to include because it's radio. And then just sit there. And then it's just dead silence in the club until someone gets up. Like, can you imagine? And especially, like, to think that you're going to be a star and be able to act like that. But it's also, it's New Orleans. So at the same time, he could act like that and people come see him again next time, you know? It's just not, I'm so, anytime I meet someone who saw him live, I am so jealous. You know, I can't imagine.
Well, we are going to take a very quick break. When we get back, lots more from filmmaker Lily Kieber. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Gonzo by the man himself, James Booker, on the heritageradionetwork.org. Keep it locked for more You Look Hungry.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by filmmaker Lily Kieber, who has created an amazing and comprehensive documentary about James Booker. It's called Bayou Maharaja, The Tragic Genius of James Booker. And before the break, we were just talking about who this person is, his music, his eccentric tendencies. And, you know, I would love to know, if you could spend an afternoon with James, what would you expect would happen?
I would expect the unexpected. I mean, if I could go back in time and spend an afternoon with him, the first thing is I would take him to the closest piano and just sit him down there. You know, because there are so many things I would love to hear, you know, him play. But it's also, I know full well that if that happened, I took him to a piano, you know, it's a total 50-50 shot on whether or not he would be in the mood to sit down and play. Or maybe he just wants to sit at the bar and drink and get sufficiently loaded. Or maybe he thinks that the CIA is after him and there is no way he's going to play anything, and in fact he's out of the bar and gone, and, you know, who knows? You know, and that's the thing, is that, like, those paranoia were really real for him. You know, it wasn't just like, ha ha, the CIA, the government sucks. It was, you know, no, they're watching me. And to back up a bit, he lost his family when he was really young. His dad died young, then his mom and sister died very close to each other. And, you know, that, as far as I can tell, that was also, you know, when the paranoia was starting to come out. And, you know, he absolutely believed that the CIA had killed his family. So why would you not be scared? That's terrifying. This, you know, also the Cold War, you know, back then. So I would hope, if we spent time together, I'd get to hear him play. But I imagine probably I would have to buy him a bunch of drinks, drive him around town for a while, watch him get stoned, and then he would disappear, you know. And it is something I've thought about. Like, is it easier to make this kind of film never having known him? You know, because, like, I don't come with that baggage. Remember there's this Tom T. Hall song, and it's all about, like, you know, this guy this guy has a friend he knows who died, and the whole song is just outlining the funeral. And then at the end, he's like, you know, I wish I could feel bad for the guy, but he still owes me $40. You know, and I think that there was a lot of feelings like that around Booker, you know, like not that he owed him $40, but, you know, like that time that, you know, that time that Booker made someone drive him around all day and then just disappeared, or showed up at their door, you know, owed the taxi driver money, so he started like taking stuff out of their house to pay the taxi, you know, like it's hard to be friends with a junkie, even a very talented one. So I think that in a way, having some time pass since his death, it sort of like allowed people to forgive those debts, you know, and concentrate on the more important thing, which is, you know, his artistic contribution. So
tell me about the story behind the title of the film.
Bhai Maharaja? And it's funny, you say it with a D, and that's how Harry Connick says it too. Like, I love Bhai Maharaja. I can't say it. So Booker was quite the showman, and he had a lot of nicknames for himself. First and foremost, the Black Liberace. I have one contract that he signed in Germany, and he insisted on being billed as the Black Liberace. But I didn't feel that that was quite a PC name for this film, you know? And so he called himself the Black Liberace, the Ivory Emperor, Piano Prince in New Orleans, Little Chopin in Living Color. I'm sure I'm forgetting some of the more outrage. Oh, the Orleanian Earthquake. You know, it's just, the list goes on and on. But for me, my favorite nickname of his was the Bhai Maharaja. You know, it's like, what is a Bhai Maharaja? What does that even mean? And yet, at the same time, once you know Booker, it's like, it makes sense. You know, it's flashy enough for him. You know, it's that sort of what I call Booker logic. You know, it makes sense if you're willing to go there. And with a lot of his, like, rambles, you know, in between his gigs or when he was just talking and talking or writing, I have a page from his autobiography in the book. If you're willing to sit there and, you know, listen very abstractly and sort of surrealistically, it makes sense. But if you're going for a literal interpretation, it means nothing. So that's the Bhai Maharaja part of it. And then the other part, you know, for one, I wanted James Booker's name in the title. But I have to be honest, there was a lot of, you know, back and forth discussions on whether or not he's a tragic genius. Whether it's my place to call him a genius, whether it's my place to call him tragic. For a while, we called him troubled, you know, and it was just, it's that point where, you know, how much do I, as a documentarian, impose my subjective view on it? Because I do think he's a tragic genius. Is it my place to call him that? I don't know. But then in the end, you know, especially on whether it should be troubled or tragic, I realize, you know, Booker himself is so flamboyant and flashy. Like, of course he would go for the superlative, you know, like, he would never take the middle of the road approach. He would go for the most outrageous, you know. So in the end, I did, you know, but I also, in thinking about James Booker, you know, I very often thought of the end of Amadeus, that film. You know, when you've gone on this whole... I love the film. I love that. I grew up with that film on VHS. And you go through this whole journey with Mozart and, you know, see his brilliance, see his troubled aspect, and then the last scene is him getting dumped in that pauper's grave. You know, and I kind of thought about that a lot with Booker, you know, that he had this amazing, intense, candle burns at both ends kind of life, and made this music that is so full of passion and joy and heartbreak and love and the whole spectrum of human emotion. And then he was just gone. You know, so for me, what could be more tragic than that?
I think about how he's influenced, you know, different other important cultural figures like Hunter S. Thompson with Gonzo. And, you know...
We should probably tell that story.
Yeah, please.
See, I always forget the good stories. So... James Booker's first... No, that's not true. James Booker's biggest known single, the only single to ever chart, was called Gonzo. And it's an organ hit. It's very kind of like smooth, 60s, sitting by the pool with your martini, like, girls in bikinis dancing kind of song. But for Booker, the title was a reference to heroin. He saw this movie that he loved called The Pusher. The drug dealer in the film's name was Gonzo, so that's where Booker got the name. So it's this like easy listening song that, you know, got up to, I think, number 3 on the Billboard hits. I could be wrong. Top 10. But it's a heroin reference. And the B-side was Cool Turkey as a reference to cold turkey. It's like, how in 1960s America could that get through? Well, because it's Booker. But Hunter S. Thompson loved that song so much. You know, apparently it would come on and he would just start screaming like a banshee. And when he was writing the motorcycle book, is it Hell's Angels? Oh, God, this is so embarrassing. I can't think of the title.
I think, well...
Y'all can edit it out. Yeah. But when Hunter S. Thompson was writing his first novel, he listened to the song over and over and over again. And so people started equating Hunter S. Thompson with the song Gonzo, and the name stuck. So it's just one more way that James Booker has influenced American culture without, you know, everyone knows Gonzo journalism. No one knows Booker, so.
So, you know, in terms of the film, it's premiered at South by Southwest. You had a very successful Kickstarter. But, you know, where is it being shown? How can people access it? What's the story behind that?
It's really tricky, you know. And again, this is my first film, so this is all new territory for me. But we've shown the film at some festivals and are going to continue to show it at festivals in America and then hopefully internationally, you know, this year. And try to get some interest in getting it broadcast. I mean, for me, the whole purpose of making the film was to get James Booker's story out there. And it's a story that really does resonate with some people. Musically inclined people, creative people, you know, fans of this kind of music love the film. But then, at the same time, not everyone loves this film. Or not everyone loves this kind of music. Not everyone loves New Orleans. Not everyone loves, you know, America's cultural contributions. And to those people, you know, they're just not going to like the film. I think that also he remains such a difficult and controversial figure, you know. So it's not, just like his music is not easy listening, the film is not a film that you can, you know, just show to anyone. I don't know. Again, people have to be willing to go there with the story, which inherently makes it a harder sell. You know, and for me, just having made the film is enough. You know, I've always said, if I break even on the film, you know, I'll be happy. That's still a long ways off. But so we're going to try to show it to festivals, try to get broadcast somewhere, and, you know, one day have it on the internet. But, you know, It's a tricky road, but at the same time, you know, if I wanted to make an easy film, I would have never made this film, you know. For me, the film has taught me personally so much about, you know, music and living and creativity and artistic integrity, you know, that I wouldn't trade it in for the world.
What can we look forward to seeing from you in the future? What are you working on currently?
I have some more. I have at least one more New Orleans feature in me. You know, another one I really want to make. I love dance in this city. Just the way that people move is unlike anything I've ever seen in my life, and I love it. I never get tired of it. Still trying to figure out, you know, how to translate that love into a film. You know, but we're in the beginning stages. Also, I would like to make some short work. I gotta tell you, like, features, it wears you out. So I would love to make, I mean, there's so many stories here. I'd like to make maybe some series or episodes or just, you know, more fun stuff, I think, really, before I start down another film that's going to take 3 years of my life.
Well, and your final thoughts on James Booker, what would you say?
I would say listen to the music first. Try to find the European albums. The stuff that's on vinyl, basically any Booker album you can find on vinyl is a safe bet. They're hard to find. You know, there's a really mixed bag of Booker that's available right now. You know, but if you can, anything that was recorded in Germany or Switzerland is ace. And I would say sit down and listen to some of that first, as a starting place, you know. I think if people start listening to the stuff from New Orleans or the stuff later in his life, it's sort of more confusing, you know, but I don't know. I still think that if you could just get Booker in a grand piano, it's the most beautiful thing ever.
Well, Lily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, thanks so much to Jack Inslee, Joe Galarraga, and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio. I'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.